We don't get million-dollar donations very often. This is the second one for mining this year.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks gets another big gift of money. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a controversial caribou hunt reaches the state Supreme Court.
What we advocated was that the Supreme Court actually find that the law enabling community hunts to begin with be stricken as unconstitutional.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The Virginia Supreme Court has ruled against the Northwest Alaska village of Kivalina in favor of an insurance company in a case that legal experts say is the first in the nation on whether insurers may be liable for claims arising from global warming. The court unanimously voted today that Kivalina's claims against AES Corporation were not covered by the Virginia-based energy company's liability insurance carrier, Steadfast Insurance Company. The ruling upheld a lower court decision. Kivalina, a native community on a barrier island, alleged in a 2008 lawsuit that greenhouse emissions by AES and other companies damaged the village by causing global warming. Steadfast claimed it did not owe AES a defense or indemnity coverage because the complaint did not allege an occurrence of property damage. No one was available at the Kivalina City office for comment. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has received another large gift from a mining company. Sumitomo, the company that runs the Pogo Gold Mine near Delta Junction, yesterday presented UAF with a check for a little over $1 million. The money, to be doled out by Sumitomo over 3 years, will go into an endowment that supports research at UAF's Department of Mining and Geological Engineering. Pogo Mine General Manager Chris Kennedy says the gift helps the mining industry meet demand for skilled workers.
UAF produces really good students out of their program. In fact, we have several working out there, and they've become shining stars for us with the experience that they've gained.
Kennedy says Pogo just welcomed a new UAF-educated mining engineer last week. The mining industry is experiencing a worldwide labor shortage, but Sumitomo Pogo president Toshihito Toyoshima says the donation isn't just about generating a workforce.
One of the important missions of the mining company, we need to support the education at schools. To support the industry first and make them understand, even they don't join the mining industry, make them understand what we are doing.
The donation from Pogo comes as the price of gold hits record highs. UAF Chancellor Brian Rogers calls it significant and reflective of the university and mining business.
We don't get million-dollar donations very often. This is the second one for mining this year, and I think it really speaks to the quality of the program and the growth of research, and the profitability of the industry today.
The Pogo gift follows on a similar contribution to the UAF mining program from Kinross Fort Knox Gold Mine last month. The contributions qualify for tax credits that cover about 80% of the donations. Money that would have gone to the state as taxes instead goes to the university. Rogers says the state legislature created the education tax credit to encourage charitable giving.
Of the first $100,000 of a contribution, $50,000 of that is a credit against their taxes. The next $200,000 is 100% credit. Donations above that amount are at the 50% credit level, up to a total potential credit of $5 million for any single taxpayer.
The university is hopeful that other companies will follow Fort Knox and Pogo in taking advantage of the state tax credits to support UAF. The UAF Mining Engineering Research Endowment supports graduate student projects. It was created to compensate for federal research funding lost since the U.S. Bureau of Mines was eliminated in the 1990s. A Texas soldier based at Fort Wainwright has been killed in Afghanistan. U.S. Army Alaska officials in a release today identified the soldier as 26-year-old Rodolfo Rodriguez Jr. of FAR, Texas. Authorities say he was killed Wednesday by insurgents using a pressure plate improvised explosive device. He joined the Army in March 2006 and twice served in Iraq. The infantryman was assigned in March 2010 to the 3rd Battalion, 21st Infantry Regiment, 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division at the Alaska base. About 4,000 soldiers from the brigade deployed for a year's tour in Afghanistan in April. This year's Neil-China subsistence caribou hunt closed for the taking of cows at midnight last night. The hunt has been going well, according to State Fish and Game Area biologist Becky Schwanke in Glen Allen. She says as of today, 1,160 caribou have been taken in the subsistence Tier 1 hunt, which is still open for taking bulls. Schwanke says the area's community hunt has taken 52 animals and the Unit 13 drawing hunts have taken 169. The Neil-China caribou hunts are accessible by road and are popular with hunters, but there is some squabbling over who gets to hunt the animals, and some organizations have taken an opposing stand against state qualifications for the community hunting permits. This week, justices of the Alaska Supreme Court listened to arguments concerning the constitutionality of the community hunt, which was authorized by the State Board of Game in 2009 but was challenged in court. John Starkey, an attorney for Otna Incorporated, the Alaska Native corporation from the Glen Allen area, could not be reached for comment today but had argued that the community hunt is constitutional. Michael Kramer, an attorney for the Alaska Outdoor Council, said that the community hunt excludes people who don't live in the Otna villages.
What we advocated was that the Supreme Court actually find that the law enabling community hunts to begin with be stricken as unconstitutional. And, you know, we hope they go that route and end this continuing uncertainty and stop the Board of Game from going back year after year and making slight changes to the program on hunt conditions.
Earlier, a state superior court judge ruled the community hunt illegally favored rural hunters, so the Board of Game reworked the rules for the community harvest, and it has gone forward this year. The AOC is also challenging this year's community hunt in Superior Court in Fairbanks. Under the state constitution, all Alaskans are eligible for subsistence use of a resource. The state Supreme Court has not handed down a decision in the case yet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, surveying the homeless in Anchorage.
Only two of them are still with us today. Life is very fragile, and it's very fragile for these individuals.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A man and a juvenile are in custody after accused of beating a homeless man in East Anchorage. Anchorage Police Lieutenant Dave Parker says 20-year-old Kenneth Taukshay Jr. has been arrested on burglary and assault charges. He will be arraigned Saturday. The juvenile is also in custody in the early morning beating. Parker says Daniel Workman was found outside a mobile home bleeding from head wounds. He was treated at a hospital for a lacerated scalp and broken facial bones. An officer and a police dog tracked four suspects to other trailers in the mobile home park. Taukshay and the juvenile were arrested, and Parker says the other two men were determined to only be witnesses to the beating. For 3 days this week, a little more than 100 volunteers walked Anchorage streets and trails and visited shelters to survey the city's chronic homeless. They also went to several agencies serving the homeless. The ultimate goal is to identify and find housing for the most vulnerable of Anchorage's residents before winter arrives. KSKA's Len Anderson has the details.
This afternoon, the Anchorage Coalition on Homelessness presented the results of its Vulnerability Registry project. In 2 days, the teams of volunteers wrote down names, took pictures, and asked 355 chronic homeless individuals 33 questions. They included time on the street, education, health status, hospital use, residency history, and jail and prison time. The local effort was part of the national 100,000 homeless campaign. The goal is to find and house 100,000 chronically homeless individuals across the nation. Over 10,000 have been housed so far. The Anchorage Coalition on Homelessness hopes to add to that tally. To establish the importance and urgency of the week's work, Coalition co-chair Trevor Storrs put up on the PowerPoint screen a picture of 10 people who had been found the most vulnerable in a previous registry taken 5 years ago.
Only two of them are still with us today. Life is very fragile, and it's very fragile for these individuals. Most of these folks are in their 40s. That was 5 years ago. Most of them died probably in their 40s or early 50s.
The volunteers went to 9 different camp areas, plus places like Brother Francis Shelter, the Anchorage Gospel Mission, the municipality's Community Service Center, Covenant House, and the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. With a couple of exceptions, they arrived at their assignments between 4 and 4:30 a.m. Storrs says that timing reduced duplication of this most difficult-to-place portion of the city's homeless.
So many times it's easy to start with the easy folks. You can just house them and make it look good and get good numbers. Well, one of the things we know is there's people out there, it's not so easy. There's a lot of things that they are dealing with. We want to know who they are, because they are the ones who are truly costing our community, if we think about it on a financial level only, a lot of dollars. But they're also the ones in the greatest need of help if we talk about the human side of things.
The financial cost of these most vulnerable is considerable, as shown in statistics presented by the coalition's other co-chair, Corrine O'Neill.
In the past 3 months, people reported that they had 540 visits total out of the 355 people. The top 5 emergency room users had over 100 visits in the past 3 months.
Ages ranged from 19 to over 70. Males were 74%, with 3/4 of them categorized as vulnerable. Only about a quarter of the females were described as vulnerable. Alaska Natives were the largest group at slightly over 40%. Whites were next at 33%. 81 individuals had been in foster care, and the same number were veterans. The most common health problems were heart conditions and asthma, and substance abuse at 71%, with over half of them suffering from both substance abuse and mental illness. It's that last dual combination plus one chronic health condition that lifts one to the top of the vulnerability list to become the top candidates for housing. Storrs anticipates few rejections.
Other places' experience is their turndown rate is extremely low. Most people want the housing. And definitely, probably one of the biggest things that will have an impact, and we know it will be the type of housing, Carlick Manor, housing first, giving them that option versus always having strings attached to it.
Carlick Manor is scheduled to open this fall and can house 46 chronically homeless alcoholics. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The issue of foregone harvest was among the topics addressed during a major fisheries science symposium that's ongoing in Anchorage. Foregone harvest is defined as fish that are counted as escapement over and above what is necessary to reach established escapement goals. The Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fishery was used as a case study during yesterday's session of the 27th annual Lowell Wakefield Fisheries Symposium being held in Anchorage. The discussion about foregone harvest was led by Steve Langdon. He's an anthropology professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Much of his talk was focused on opening up opportunities for the native people of Bristol Bay to harvest surplus sockeye salmon that makes its way past the traditional commercial fishing districts. He says there are challenges in law, regulation, and policy for people in Bristol Bay to commercialize those salmon if they are not operating in the traditional commercial fishery.
Right now you've got certain legal limitations on where fish can be harvested, and then they go up the creek. Well, guess what? They are still nutritionally invaluable. People use them up there. If they're up the creek, why aren't there the opportunities in those particular places that I mentioned before for people to be able to make use of them?
Currently, it's illegal for sockeye salmon that make it through the commercial fishing districts in Bristol Bay to be harvested and sold commercially, despite the fact that in some years, a percentage of those fish are not needed to meet the preseason escapement goals. Langdon suggested area villages, organizations, and individuals could be strengthened if a system was developed to allow those fish to be harvested, either commercially or through subsistence fishing efforts, and then sold. Often sockeye salmon fishermen in Bristol Bay are limited in the amount of fish they can harvest due to poundage limits placed on them by processors who only have so much processing capacity available. In some years, the imposition of limits means that large numbers of fish make it through the commercial fishing districts and are counted as escapement. The symposium runs through tomorrow. The Kensington mine accident that killed Juneau resident Joe Tagaban last week is the eighth U.S. mining fatality in 2011, according to the Mining Safety and Health Administration. It was also the first explosives fatality for the year. An updated report from MSHA indicates Tagaban was waiting on a ramp for the blast to be initiated, and when it was, small rock and debris traveled through a 3-inch diameter diamond borehole, striking him. The regulatory agency says the hole should have been mapped and plugged. The report lists several best practices for using underground explosives that includes evacuating all persons from the designated blasting site. The underground section of the Kensington mine where the accident occurred was closed for a week during the initial investigation. While the mine is back in full operation, no blasting can be conducted in production stopes until MSHA says it's safe. Stopes are openings or rooms created in the process of extracting the gold ore. Core Alaska spokesman Tony Ebersol says the company is working with MSHA to finalize blasting protocols in production stopes. Blasting activities related to mine development are continuing. The company says it doesn't expect the closure will impact 2011 production levels. Through the first 6 months of this year, Kensington has produced more than 49,000 ounces of gold.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at NMSUSA.com.
And by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Josh Edge. This week on AK, fungus, the tasty kind. The mushrooms we love to eat are usually found in the produce section of the grocery store, but that approach is too easy for a group of mushroom lovers who gathered in Cordova earlier this month. KCHU's Tony Gorman joined them for mushroom hunting and eating at the Cordova Fungus Festival and has this story.
The term used to describe a mushroom hunt is foray, and 20 of us decided to brave the pouring rain on a cold Saturday afternoon with the hopes of finding a few to take back to town. Leading the foray is Kate Mohat, a mycologist for the U.S. Forest Service. The search turned up some choice varieties, including a wavy fungus called a hedgehog. This species is closely related to chanterelles, which are used in cream sauces, soups, and sautés.
You found anything good yet?
We found a hedgehog.
All right.
Yeah.
Good edible mushroom.
And we found a Russula emetica. Don't eat that one.
No.
That mushroom is commonly known as the sickener. If eaten, it can cause diarrhea, vomiting, and abdominal cramps. But after a two-hour search, the group was able to find some popular edible varieties, too.
We found some of the choicest species that occur in this area, including King Bolete or Porcini, or Boletus edulis, also known as in Latin, which is one of the most highly prized edible mushrooms found worldwide. It's very popular in Italy, France, as well as the United States.
The payoff for 2 hours of searching comes later in the evening at the fungus feast. The meal was prepared at the Reluctant Fisherman Inn restaurant. Diners traveled from as far as Germany to sample Cordova's fungus delicacies.
All righty then. Make it pretty.
Meet Patrick Hamilton, the man behind the feast. The Michael chef's interest in mushrooms began when he moved to Rio Nido, California in 1970.
I lived on top of a canyon, and there were all these trees, Doug firs and madrones and things like that, and all these mushrooms. And in 1970, there weren't that many mushroom books. But some local people knew which ones we could eat. And there was like two out of the hundreds we found we would eat. And I started cooking them. And that's how I started doing it.
Over two decades, Hamilton has been teaching mushroom recipes while developing some of his own. He has written almost 200 articles on the finding and cooking of mushrooms. For the feast, he had a special menu in store.
We're going to start off with a wild mushroom soup. I call it mushroom soup to die for. I thought that would be kind of cute. And then we're going to do a warm maitake, which is called Hen of the Woods salad with fresh greens and a citrusy vinaigrette. And then we're going to do braised short ribs with porcini gravy. And we're going to do locally found hedgehog mushrooms, butter poached over linguine. And we're going to do cabbage with black chanterelles and juniper berries.
Then there's dessert.
A bread pudding, which actually infused with a candy cap mushroom, which, when it dries, it has a savory but maple flavor.
Members of the staff work long hours preparing for the huge meal. At the stove, Chef Jason Raridan is making the mushroom soup.
The mushrooms is onion, celery, carrots, and white mushroom soup. We're going to add stock with cream, and stock, and heavy cream and some chives and garnish.
After long hours in the kitchen, the menu is put to the test in front of 100 people at the restaurant. As everyone is enjoying an evening of fun, each dish is served one by one. And they didn't disappoint.
Well, I think the soup was world class. I just thought that was one of the best flavors served tonight. All of the mushrooms are good. The soup was the best.
Rich, rich sauce, definitely lots of mushroom flavor, and the meat is delicious.
With those reviews, Fungus Festival organizer Aaron Cooper describes the feast as a success.
The most exciting thing about the Fungus Feast is that every dish has mushrooms in it, and it's a new flavor for most people. It's a new flavor and adventure in culinary dining, so to speak, for people who have only had mushrooms in salad, you know, or portobello.
Hopefully those who ate at the feast will see that mushrooms are more than just a piece of topping. Reporting from Cordova, I'm Tony Gorman.
We're bottling wine now.
Now it's time for the segment we call 300 Villages. This week, we're visiting Chattanooga, an old gold mining area about 30 miles north of Fairbanks on the Steese Highway, and Glen Allen, a community at the crossroads of the Glen and Richardson Highways.
I'm Shirley Franklin from Chattanooga Lodge, approximately 28 miles out of Fairbanks. I believe Chattanooga means white fish, if I'm correct. I asked some natives many, many years ago, and she did some research, and that's what she came up with. So we have a gold dredge across the street where a lot of people come out to look at it, and ours place is just like a restaurant. You can hike a little bit around this area, but now that people are starting to move in, a lot of it's becoming private. So you can't get on the property anymore. But there's some trails here for four-wheeling and snow machining. And then people do a lot of bicycling on the road out here in the summertime. They have marathons out here. Some of the land is coming open for people to purchase. So there's more and more people coming in. The state takes care of the road. They do a real good job of maintaining it. And so we get a lot of snow machiners or sometimes dog mushers come over. So, I mean, we've got trees that right now, that it's beautiful, the colors of the trees. Wintertime is nice with the snow, but that's about all. We've got a river that's about 9 miles from us. A lot of people float the river. I see beaver. I see lynx, fox. Moose. It's been a long time since I've seen a bear, but they have been around.
I'm Kathy Stratton in Glen Ellen. I'm a library aide.
And as far as our library goes, we have a great Alaska section. Sometimes people have trouble finding something in Anchorage or Fairbanks that we have here in our Alaska section. We are 189 miles east-northeast of Anchorage. When people drive through, they don't think there's much here because it's just drive through on the highway and they think they've been through Glen Ellyn. But if you start looking around, there's something behind every bush. We actually do have a local radio station. We have a Bible college and a community college. We have a medical center. It's a crossroads. Most people coming into Alaska will come through here, going in or coming out. In the 80s, it was a bumper-to-bumper practically, and now it's not nearly as many. We'll fly now instead of drive. Well, we do have a wonderful view of the Wrangell Mountains, which are gorgeous, but just coming along the highway, it's just, a few houses and businesses along the road, and that's what most people see, unless they stick around a while. Of course, they're active volcanoes. Mount Wrangell especially, it hasn't erupted in a long time, but you can see the plumes of steam escaping often. And I think every year it dips down to at least 50 below, but it doesn't usually stay that way.
That was Shirley Franklin, a lodge owner in Chattanooga, and Kathy Stratton, a librarian in Glen Ellyn. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Mike Mason from Anchorage. Our AK guest host this week was Josh Edge. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.